This is a Defocus Media production. What's up, everyone? It's your favorite optometrist, Dr. Daryl Glover.
And I'm Dr. Jennifer Lyerly, resident optometry nerd.
And welcome to Defocus Media, optometry's number one podcast, where we discuss the hottest topics, latest technology, eyewear, practice management, and more. So sit back, relax, and defocus. What's up, everyone? It's your favorite optometrist, Dr. Daryl Glover. Happy holidays. I'm super excited today because I get to hang out with one of my favorite colleagues, a dry eye guru, Dr. Anna Lazar. How are you doing today, Dr. Lazar?
Hey, oh my gosh, thank you. You're so sweet. I'm good. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. And I don't know about you, Dr. Lazar, but around this time of the year, I am bombarded by something that really plagues my office on a day-to-day basis, and that's dry eye. I mean, the weather is changing. People are traveling. They're in the malls where it's dry, or they're working overtime. So they always come into my office complaining about dry eyes. Please tell me you're experiencing the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? What I've noticed since I've been practicing, I'm smarter now, okay? It's like live and learn. So I start treating my dry eye patients in August. I bring them in and I start prepping them for this season. So yes, this is the season. And often you'll have patients like, oh my, but my eyes are not dry. They're watering. Yes. We got to treat that.
Yeah.
So absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I'm super excited today because we have two colleagues that are really going to talk about dry eye. But of course, before we jump into that, let's really get to know who's hanging out with us today. Are you down for that, Dr. Lazar?
Yes.
Awesome. Well, today we are very excited to partner with Oyster Point, and we have two stars here. We have Jeffrey Now, who's going to give us his background, and also we have Dr. Marion Maxey. How are you two doing today?
Doing great, Daryl.
Doing great.
Awesome. Well, Jeffrey, I know you hold a big title over there, man, but ladies first. So we're going to have to take it to Dr. Maxey so she gives us a little background about who she is, where she's from, and how did you get into this lovely profession known as eye care, if you don't mind sharing with us?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Daryl. I've been in eye care for over 30 years. I'm an ophthalmologist, and up until a year ago, I was a practicing ophthalmologist, just like all of you, day in, day out, seeing those dry eye patients. And when the COVID epidemic hit, I am one of those physicians that jumped ship. I was offered a great opportunity by Jeff to join Oyster Point as chief medical officer. And so I thought this was my opportunity to not just help the patients in my chair, but all the dry eye patients out there, all the patients with front of the eye disease. And as a cornea fellowship trained surgeon, I thought this is my opportunity. So I dove headfirst into the world of pharma, and I haven't looked back for 1 second. So I've been at Oyster Point for a year and had the privilege to work with Jeff and our incredible team as we've brought Tyrvaya to the market, FDA approved, to help our dry eye patients.
Awesome. I love it. And you know, that's the beautiful thing about eye care. There is so much that you can do. It's not about just sitting in that exam lane, refracting, doing medical. You can do so much more outside of that exam lane. And that's one reason why I truly love this profession. Jeff, tell us a little bit about yourself, man. A little bit about your background, you know, how you got into eye care, and let's just, build this story up, man.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for having us on. And, you know, much like Marion, I've actually ironically been in eye care for a long time. I'm probably the only CEO in the eye care space that also started out his career as a tech in a multi-specialty practice and sort of worked my way up as a retinal photographer, went off to college and worked my way through college by harvesting corneas at the eye bank. So I've been in ophthalmology my entire career. And then as I transitioned over, thinking I was going to go into medicine, and I was in medical school, thought I was going to be in eye care, and then ultimately made the decision to move over into the industry side of the business, and have been involved in ophthalmology for 20 years and clinical development of both drugs and devices. So I spent my entire career somehow touching eye care.
Yeah, I think so, man. You've done it all. Both of you have done it all. So, you know,
the eyes have it.
Let me throw my number out there. I've been in the industry for about 21 years. How about you, Dr. Lazar?
Oh, well, I graduated in 2015.
Okay. All right. Well, I was a technician too before I went to optometry school, and I sold glasses. So I've really been all into this from the bottom up, but I love the profession for sure. So, you know, it's no doubt about it that, you know, we're here to really talk about Tyrvaya. But before we jump into that, Oyster Point, what is Oyster Point all about? We see that name popping up all over the place, but a lot of my colleagues, a lot of my fellow optometrists and eye care professionals out there may not know what this brand is about and what that story is about. So if you don't mind sharing that before we jump into learning more about some of the products and solutions that you have for our patients.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, Oyster Point was founded in 2017, and really the sole focus was to create a company that was focused on front of the eye, anterior chamber disease. Many of the folks that came along with us, we've worked for many, many years in retina. Many of us have been on teams that have launched drugs such as Lucentis into the marketplace. And so we were really excited about looking at the front of the eye as really sort of the next frontier with regards to innovation. And we just felt that, unfortunately, the pharmaceuticals that were being brought to the table were a little bit stale, and they weren't innovative with all the advances going on in medicine. And so we founded Oyster Point with that concept of bringing transformative, innovative medicines to the front of the eye. And so Tyrvaya was our first product that we were developing, which is obviously a little bit out of the norm, which is a nasal spray to treat an ocular surface disease. But then we also have a pipeline that is focused on bringing gene therapy to the front of the eye. So we're actually delivering AAV gene therapy to the lacrimal gland and harnessing the lacrimal gland to really do drug delivery to the ocular surface. And we think that that has the possibility to transform the way that we deliver therapeutics to the ocular surface, where once we inject that patient's lacrimal gland, the patient is set for some period of time that remains to be seen. We're also working on some novel antimicrobial therapies in our pipeline called bacteriophages. These are really harnessing these small little viral particles to go after bacteria. And we're obviously working on a number of other things we can't talk about just yet, but we think we got the coolest pipeline in front of the eye, and we got a cool company that's really only focused on front of the eye. And many companies out there can claim that they're in eye care, but we are truly ingrained in eye care.
Well, I'll tell you what, before Dr. Lazar geeks out on these mechanisms and Tyrvaya, I want to know, where did this name come from? Because it is unique and it is different. So if you can give me a little bit of a background of how this came about, then we'll let Dr. Lazar grill you about questions about this new product that you have on the market.
Perfect. And I'll tell the story, and I'm going to apologize. It'll be wildly disappointing when I get to the end of the story. But basically, the company, you know, as companies go, sometimes companies are multi-asset companies, and one asset may be bought, and then another asset spins out as a new company. And that's what happened here with Oyster Point. So the asset that now is known as Tyrvaya spun out of a parent company, became another entity, and the company needed a name. And we can tell you that these weren't the most creative people in the world. So they looked up at the street sign where their office was located, which was Oyster Point Boulevard. And they said, we're going to call it Oyster Point Pharma. And here we are.
Well, that, you know what? That's usually how it happens. That's just the truth.
That's right.
Naming is the hardest.
Yeah. And then once you you know, once you get some name recognition out there, it's hard to then change things up and go a different route because people have been here in Oyster Point for so many years. So, you know, I think it's a unique name. It's kind of a cool name. If you look across pharma, I didn't realize this until we started to put our logo up with everybody else, but not many pharma companies have two names. So we're one of those unique groups. You know, we stand out when it's the Pfizers and the Mercks of the world next to us.
Yeah, definitely. And you know what? So many people love oysters. So I think they can all just like that.
Yeah. I will tell you, a funny story on the oyster is our first logo was a shell with a tear where the oyster would be. And my boys pointed out real quickly, you know, we thought it was a cool logo. They said, "Dad, that's a scallop shell. It's not an oyster shell. Oyster shells are ugly. You need to change that logo."
Leave it to kids, and they'll tell the truth. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. So can I ask about the mechanism and how did Tyrvaya, how did you discover Tyrvaya? I always want to know where did it come from? Because, you know, the story matters. So tell us, please.
Well, obviously, I think everyone knows the story around electrical neurostimulation inside of the nasal cavity. And while the development of that product was happening, a side project began, which was, you know, them smartly asking, well, what if we could do this with a pharmaceutical? And so they started to basically search through libraries of compounds and really focusing on those receptors that are known to reside on the trigeminal nerve in the nasal cavity. So they were able to narrow it down to specific classes. There are certain classes of receptors that we know that are on the nerve that when you stimulate them, nothing happens. There are certain classes when you stimulate them, we get pain. So for instance, you know, if you were to put hot pepper sauce or wasabi up your nose, you'll tear, but I would say not necessarily the experience that you're looking for. And
that's how I like to spend my Friday nights to cure my dry eyes. So
yeah, that's right. And so this particular class of receptors was identified. And what's interesting about the class of receptors is they're made up of 5 subunits. And the way that they work is once the drug or a ligand binds to them, they open a pore and allow ions to flow in, and that depolarizes the nerve and causes the nerve to send a signal back to the various structures that produce the tear film. And not all of these receptors will cause tearing. So very specific receptors will. And so we found that this product, this drug, varenicline, which was already out on the market, was one of those drugs that will stimulate these receptors. So one of the nice things about this particular product was more than 20 million patients have taken this product orally for smoking cessation. So we had a giant safety record, a big safety database, obviously at much higher doses than we would deliver in the nasal cavity. And so it allowed us to move really quickly through development, but also it cleared some of those hurdles that we often run into in drug development where you don't know what sort of safety issues you're going to run into. And we had a studied product that had been in the market for a long period of time. So we felt very comfortable in delivering this to patients. So varenicline binds to that receptor. It depolarizes the nerve. A signal is then sent back up through the ganglion into the lacrimal glands, the meibomian glands, and the goblet cells, and we get stimulation. So as long as we have healthy gland tissue, healthy goblet cells, the nerve that's opposed to them will stimulate.
Great. So this is very interesting, but how about the meibomian glands? Because most people do have the lid disease, you know, the 85% of dry eye is evaporative dry eye. How does it affect the meibomian glands since we know they're already not working well?
Yeah. So if the gland is able to produce meibum, then mm-hmm. we can stimulate that gland. I would say okay. One of the things that we would never promise anyone is we're certainly not going to unclog an inspissated gland. We're certainly not going to make an atrophic gland come back from nothing. But we do think that continued stimulation of the gland not only will produce meibum, but for those glands that are sort of 50% gone, we can potentially have the opportunity to bring them back because you're getting that regular electrical stimulus. So we won't be able to treat every patient with meibomian gland disease, but I will say that the one thing that the product does do very well is we have great data on goblet cell stimulation, lacrimal gland stimulation. So even that mucoaqueous gel in those patients that don't have good meibom is still helpful and protective to the ocular surface.
Yeah, that's great. I don't
know, Dr. Nexai, if you want to add anything there.
Well, I think that the nice thing is for meibomian gland disease, we now have so many different treatments available. So if we take a patient who has dead, keratinized, atrophic meibomian gland, sadly, we can't make those glands come back. But the glands that are just inspissated or secreting toothpaste instead of canola oil, I would hope that if you can get those glands healthier, the chronic stimulation with Tyrvaya of the nerves that stimulate the meibomian glands should keep them working and keep them in better shape. So one of the ways I see that those patients may need to be treated is through a multifactorial approach. I mean, it's a multifactorial disease. We probably need to augment their diet. We need to stimulate the meibomian glands. We need to unclog them. But Tyrvaya theoretically can keep them open and working.
Does that make sense? That's great to know. Oh, absolutely. Because you know what? Now that you're saying it, it makes me very happy because what I do, I have, you know, I do IPL, I do my meibomian gland expression, I do Blefex in the office, I have tear care. And I kind of came to this approach that you're saying currently. I have been implementing these treatments and then adding the Tyrvaya since it came out and became available as an additive therapy to patients. And so far, the feedback has been amazing.
It's great to hear. But I do think that you've touched on one of the more complex parts of dry eye care, because it's so hard, even though we think we know who's aqueous deficient versus who's evaporative. The fact is that if you have an unhealthy tear film, it will break down, whether it's due to evaporative or aqueous deficient. But we have shown with Tyrvaya that we can stimulate the goblet cells to degranulate. So we're secreting all this mucin, and then the lacrimal glands secreting 1,500 proteins, antimicrobials, anti-inflammatories, and creating, as Jeff said, this very thick, healthy mucoaqueous layer. So that alone, add a little bit of lipid, you're going to be in much better shape than you started before. And over time, we've seen from our studies that looking at the symptoms data, patients do feel better using Tyrvaya. And we've studied it out to 105 days, but in our Mystic trial, we went out to 84 days. And in those patients, not only were the Schirmers sustained, but patients were feeling better. We studied that at least out to 4 weeks, the eye dryness score.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you started to go into the data and the numbers, because that was the next question I was going to say. Let's talk about the data, because you're talking about signs and you're talking about symptoms. Not every product out there can say that. So let's elaborate a little bit more on that. And if you can kind of walk us through the type of studies and all that jazz that you had during this research and when you were digging into it.
Yeah. So we looked at a number of things. I think, you know, one of the conversations that Mary and I have often is when we design studies or when anyone designs studies, everybody tries to answer all the questions in one study, right? So we do every known diagnostic out there, but many times we don't take into account how diagnostic number one affects diagnostic number two, affects diagnostic number three. So we were very focused and we said, look, if what this product does is it stimulates tear production, well, Schirmer score is a clear sign endpoint that we want to look at. So we looked at Schirmer scores, and we've consistently done that through all of our studies. And then on the symptom side, we looked at symptoms both in the clinic, so in your exam chair, but also in a controlled adverse environment chamber. So a desiccating environment with high airflow. And, you know, the idea was we would look at it in both conditions. Some companies will actually use that chamber to sort of screen out patients that don't become symptomatic. We actually put it right smack in the middle of the trial because we wanted to look at it like we were putting those patients on a plane and sending them off on a plane ride for 2 hours. And so we have, you know, really good data, and you can see in our publications that are now out there online for the onset one and the onset two studies, but we had statistically significant improvements in not only the categorical change of 10 millimeters in Schirmer score, but mean change in Schirmer score. And then also in our onset one study, we had statistically significant improvements in symptoms, both in the chamber as well as in the exam chair. In the onset two, we did run into a little bit of a snafu with this funny little COVID pandemic that popped up. And as we were trying to put patients into that chamber, unfortunately, it became problematic. So we had to stop putting patients that close in proximity to each other. So we were able to show the benefit in the exam chair, but in that controlled adverse environment, we lost about half of our sample, unfortunately. So, you know, we're really excited about the data. I certainly encourage everybody to go out. Our publications are in peer reviewed online and open access to everybody. We chose eye dryness score and we chose Schirmer score so that, you know, we could have two endpoints, one that showed, you know, the tear production, one that was used for other dry eye products out there. So it wasn't a new assessment, the eye dryness score. And we didn't do, you know, a shotgun approach of let's look at 15 different endpoints and just see which one sticks to the wall.
The other thing I think that is unique about our studies is we took all comers. So to qualify, you didn't have to do a washout. You didn't have to fail artificial tears. You could have an eye dryness score of 0, meaning, you know, I feel great, to 100, and your Schirmer's had to be less than 10. So the goal was to really mimic the patients that you and I see walking into the office, right?
So you mean real patients is essentially is
real yeah. world, real patients, not saying, your Schirmer's is less than 5. Okay. So you're not going to work. You know, we didn't do that. We took everyone. And the mean Schirmer entering the studies was 5, but you could be, you know, anywhere less than 10, you got in. As long as your nerves were working, your trigeminal nerve was working.
And I think that's an important point because as you guys probably see in the clinic, when we started the study, we saw that many companies, when they looked at their drugs, they really would only look at that severe end of the spectrum. So the really unhealthy patients. And then when they hand you the pharmaceuticals and they say, okay, go treat your patients, now you don't get the same response you're seeing in the trial, but because it's a totally different patient population. So we really tried to mimic the population that we knew would walk through the door in the clinic. And I think that's why the expectations that we're seeing now in the commercial scenario are really well accepted by patients and physicians because you're seeing that data that we had in the clinical trial.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I'm a man of, I don't like to, when I'm looking at data, I don't want to see the fluff. I want the real deal because when I have communication with my patients, they know I'm bringing the real deal. They know I'm bringing innovation and they want to, you know, have the best of the best. But a lot of times we do see a bunch of data out here and you can see that it's pointing in that one direction because that's the direction that they want. But to be able to have mild, moderate, severe dry eye patients, just like when I walk into my office, I experience that every single day. That's priceless information, priceless data, and it makes it easier to really have that conversation in the exam room with that patient. Something I wanted to touch on, and before I jump into that, Dr. Lazar, did you have any additional questions in regards to the mechanisms or some of the data and research? Because you know me, I want to jump into, you know, some of this real world stuff, you know, like how do we communicate this with the patients and other information like that?
So I do have one question, and then we'll, because I want to know what that answer to your question as well. So when you did the TRI, did you have in mind, because, okay, let me say it this way. When I first heard about the nasal spray TRI 2 years ago at SECO, I had in mind for some reason, this will be as needed nasal spray. So I'm working on my computer, I'm doing my work, doing charting, and my eyes feel dry. I'm just going to use this spray in each nostril. I get my tearing, I'm done. Because what we saw at that point was the eyeball started to tear within 5 minutes after installation, which is, I mean, kind of like a miracle, let's be honest here. but now we're seeing based on studies, it was administered, the titration was twice a day. So what can you tell us more? Can I recommend patients more than that, or we should really stick based on what the study says? And how long? What is it, indefinite use, or are we using it for, you know, 100 days or 40, what, a month, and then we stop, we take a break? How do we do this? How do we communicate? Because those are the questions I get from my patients.
Yeah.
So please tell me.
No, I mean, those are great questions. So first, let's just talk about how we landed on twice daily dosing. So some of it is science, and some of it is human nature. And as you know, if we tell your patients to take something 15 times a day, that's not going to go so well, right? And so one of the things that I think was really important is we were able to leverage some data that was available to us where during the development of the electrical neurostimulation, patients were able to use the product as needed. And where patients ultimately landed, ironically, was 1.97 times per day, right? So two times per day. And then when we think about you know, what patients do on a normal day, you know, they'll take their dose of medication in the morning. If you make them take it at lunch, they're going to leave it at home. They're going to forget it. You know, there's going to be some reason why they don't get to it. They're busy during the day. But if we can give them that twice daily dosing in the afternoon, they will be more compliant. So we felt that BID dosing was going to be the most compliant for most patients, and also covered them with that tear film throughout their waking hours of the day. So when in the clinical trial, we said, look, take it when you wake up in the morning, take it when you come home from work at night. That covers you through those waking hours. Now there's even, we're hearing some patients wanting to take it later in the evening because they're more problematic overnight. I don't know that there's anything necessarily wrong with it, but that's not, you know, we studied it twice a day during those waking hours. And that's kind of how we landed on twice daily dosing. But the idea of treating chronically was also important because we know, so if we look at mouse studies, so there's some really interesting mice studies that come out of Japan where they inject mice with Botox into their lacrimal gland. So it shuts down the lacrimal gland production. And as we all know, Botox after a while will wear off, and lo and behold, the lacrimal gland comes back. And so what we see is as when the lacrimal gland gets shut down right after the injection, we see tear film production go down. We see corneal fluorescein staining go up. And then lo and behold, when the lacrimal gland starts secreting again, everything normalizes. And so the idea was we wanted to normalize and reestablish that tear film homeostasis. So twice daily use would put that tear film back onto the ocular surface. And as you know, this is a chronic disease. So we do think that it's something that patients should take over long periods of time. We obviously have studied it out to 105 days, but I think you know, as you know, there's going to be patients who use it, you know, intermittently for more episodic treatment because maybe they have problems staring at screens all day. There's going to probably be patients that use it during certain times of the year and they have seasonal dry eye. And then there's going to be patients that use it all the time. So, you know, we think that it's your natural tear film as a treatment really needs to be there all the time. And so, you know, we think it's a chronic therapy, but depending upon where you are on that spectrum, you may use it more or less. And interestingly enough, we hope that what this product does is if a patient does stop, they'll realize, oh, wow, I've got that symptomatic feeling back again. I've got that gritty sensation. I've got all the things I hated about dry eye. And then they'll come back to the product. Whereas with many of the products now, sometimes they don't know whether it's working, whether it's not working. And so when they go off of it, it's really no different than when they were on. And they're like, I don't know. Maybe it worked. Maybe it didn't. So what we're hoping is to be able to provide them something that also gives them some symptomatic benefit that they'll recognize when they're on the product versus when they're off the product.
No, absolutely. And so do you have a rough idea how long, once you do the spray and it starts, the tear film starts to increase within 5 minutes, how long, how many hours does it last, that stimulation?
Yeah, this is the million dollar question. So I'm going to leave it to Marion to answer. But one of the things that I'll just say is we're trying to understand that better. But I'll tell you about the receptors and then Marion can tell you about some data that we've been generating. But the receptors themselves undergo a process called smoldering activation. So once the drug binds to the receptor, it's very tight. It doesn't come off the receptor. And so you can have activation of these receptors for many minutes to hours after the delivery of the nasal spray. And sometimes the drug will come off a receptor and go to another one and open that receptor up. And so it's a dynamic process. Mm-hmm. On the ocular surface, though, Marion can share with you some of the things that we're looking at now.
So I want to differentiate. We talked about the neurostimulation, the true tear, and that was an on-off switch, right? So in Tyrvaya, we have pharmacologic neuroactivation with, as Jeff said, smoldering activation. So everybody asks this question. It's such a good question. How long does it last? So first of all, remember I told you you're going to get all this mucin and then all this aqueous and it's going to make this beautiful gel. In minutes, I can't tell you. I can tell you that we're looking at this. We have a piece of equipment that's not FDA approved yet. It's called the Tear Film Imager. It's made in Israel with the Israeli military technology that can image the tear film to the nanometer. So it's sort of like an OCT of your tear film. So we have studies ongoing now to look at that, but I can tell you that, and this is very anecdotal, so remember, the N is 3. We did take 3 people and put them in front of the tear film imager. I was one. Dr. Now was one, and our vice president of medical affairs is another, and 2 out of 3 of us have dry eyes, aqueous deficient. So we measured ourselves before we took Tyrvaya, and then 5 minutes after we took Tyrvaya. So if 3,000 is normal, 3,000 nanometers of your mucoaqueous layer. And pre-Tyrvaya, I was around 2,200. Post-Tyrvaya, I was 3,600, 5 minutes later. 2 hours later, I was 3,300. And then the technician had to fly back to Israel. So I don't know. I can tell you in me, it lasted for 2 hours minimum. I also can tell you that the eye dryness scores that we did in our studies were done before. So the patients came in, they filled out their eye dryness score. Like, how do you feel, Ina? Fill it out. And then the drug was administered. And looking at that data, the symptoms, the symptomatic relief is 12 hours, right? Because they dosed the night before, and then they're coming in the next morning, and we can tell that their symptoms are improved before they get administered the drug in the office in our FDA pivotal trials. But that was a really long answer to a really good question.
I loved it. That was perfect answer. The truth is, it was perfect answer. I'm sorry, Daryl. I have one more, and they'll be quick.
I have all night, Dr. Lazar. So whatever.
I just have one more question. So I have a lot of patients. I work in this. Like, most of my patients are these young professionals. They're all on screens. And there's a lot of allergies, and a lot of my patients actually have a lot of sinus issues. They have postnasal drip, they have polyps. And what I've noticed when I offered the Tyrvaya to them, they were concerned just because it was a spray. Have you heard about any of these? Is this a concern? Should I tell the patient, listen, don't worry, it's not an issue at all, or we still don't know, let's just wait and then see what happens?
Yeah, so it's a great question. You know, obviously in our clinical trials, we try to enroll patients that aren't on a number of other pharmaceuticals just because we want to understand the safety profile of this drug. So the answer that I would give to you is we've not studied it in patients that deliver concomitant nasal sprays. Right now in our FDA approved label, there are no contraindications associated with delivering it to a patient that's on another nasal spray. What we would probably tell people is to spread out the delivery. So you wouldn't give one drug and then give the other drug at the same time. You'd probably put some space in between. And I think that's fairly standard in the ENT community also to tell you not to take them at the exact same time as well. But we, you know, the real answer is we don't have data, but obviously as more and more people in the real world use it, you know, we'll be able to see how that works. But in the clinical trials, we don't have any data on patients that are on other nasal spray products.
That's great. Thank you so much for this. It makes the conversation, because the drug is new. I'm happy to try it out and use it with my patients, and they're excited about the new technology. But there's always a concern, and I like that there is no contraindications. That's what we want.
Yeah. And, you know, When it comes to patients, you know, you really have to build trust with your patients, right? And when you come to your patients and you tell them you're gonna treat their dry eyes by them putting something in their nose, they kind of look at you like a baby, right? So I really want to have this conversation, and I want you to kind of paint a picture of what this dialogue should look like with these patients that's sitting in front of us, because you know, some of the patients, I live in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina. I personally feel like it's some of the most brilliant people in the world here. You know, we're surrounded by Duke, NC State, Carolina. You got attorneys, you got doctors. I mean, all walks of life here, right? So, you know, some of these patients come in looking at you like you're crazy, but some come in and they might have known about previous intranasal treatments that didn't work. So how do you have that conversation with your patients that, you know, this is going to work? I mean, we as optometrists and eye care professionals know about the trigeminal nerve, but not everybody does. So if we can kind of touch on that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I think, and I'll let Marion jump in as well, but, you know, one of the most important pieces of data out there that we often talk about came out of Dr. Steve Flugfelder's lab, and they anesthetized one side of the nasal cavity and then measured tear production. And in fact, if you anesthetize the nasal cavity, 40% less tear production on that side of the face. And so we know that the nasal cavity is responsible for just normal basal tear production. And we all have probably experienced that if we have a cold or sinusitis and we're not breathing through our nose and we go to sleep at night, we wake up the next morning, our eyes are dry and crusty. And it's because we're not getting that airflow across nasal cavity. So, you know, what we usually talk to patients about is there are a number of ways to stimulate tear production. You know, obviously you've experienced one way, which is you get an eyelash in your eye and you start to tear, or you get some dust in your eye. But also, if you, you know, get something into your nose that stimulates that trigeminal nerve, or nowadays we can just say, remember when you got your COVID test and you jammed that Q-tip up there, probably caused you to tear and sneeze amongst other things. But, you know, I think really talking to the patient that there's these two driving forces, there's an ocular driving force for tear production and there's a nasal driving force. And we're leveraging that one because no matter how damaged your ocular surface is, in most patients, that nasal cavity is still able to drive tear production. And Dr. Max, I don't know if you want to add anything.
Well, so Jeff stole a little bit of my thunder because we've all had COVID tests. If you haven't had a COVID test, you're living under a rock. And that makes my eyes water. So yes, we know from Flugfelder's work that it's actually 34% of the basal tear film comes from breathing through your nose. But the other thing is, when you have dry eyes, and we know because we've dealt with these patients and we see how much they're suffering, how every blink hurts, the last thing they want to do is put something in their eye that's going to stink or burn. No matter, when your eyes are that dry, you can put preservative-free tears in, and patients relay to us that they burn, that they stink, they're not comfortable. So this is, I think, a wonderful alternative. One, you don't have to aim, which is so hard for so many of our patients. Two,
now, it's hard for me. I'll let you guys in on a little secret. I don't...
Daryl,
they went on. We lost you, Daryl.
Oh,
your like son came to
give me a card to say happy holidays. So but what I was getting at was, you know, I'll let you know a secret. I don't like anything in my eyes. So if you give me an alternative, I'm gonna run with that by all means. So I could definitely understand that.
Well, and the other thing is, when we put things in our eyes, they are washing away all the healthy things that our body is producing to heal itself, right? Like our mucin layer. And mucin is critical to your tears sticking to your eye, staying on your eye, keeping your vision healthy. So if less is more in this situation. And the other thing I think you can say to your patients is, though it's totally foreign to this, to us, the eye care providers, to even discuss the nose, to look below the zygomatic arch, like we don't even look there, but this mechanism of action stimulates all three layers of your tear film. And I think we've all discussed with our patients, you know, your tears are like salad dressing with oil and vinegar. And if the oils are unhealthy, the vinegar evaporates. So we've had these conversations in many different forms. But even your Nobel Prize winner from Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina, I think they're going to understand that there is a connection between your nose and your eye. Our bodies are super complex, and this connection will stimulate your own body to heal itself and produce all three layers of the tears. And I just want to piggyback off of the Japanese mouse study that Jeff talked about earlier, where they injected the botulinum toxin into the lacrimal glands. So he's right. Tear production went down, fluorescein staining went up. But the other thing that went up is all the inflammatory cytokines, all the stuff we talk about all the time, interleukins, MMP9, all the stuff that you and I are talking about with inflammatory markers. When the botulinum wore off and the natural tears were produced, homeostasis was restored naturally. All those inflammatory markers disappeared because the lacrimal gland is a protein producing factory that will just gush onto the eye when stimulated, 1,500 different proteins to heal the ocular surface and reestablish that homeostasis. And so I think that may be too complicated, but if you do have those very erudite patients, they may love hearing that story.
I love it. You know what? I might even send them a clip of this podcast so they can get the breakdown from top to bottom. How about that?
Well, I know who you're treating. I have the same people.
I love it. I love it. Well, you know, that's great to hear. And I love those tips. And I really love the alternative route because, like I said, I don't like anything in my eyes. I could torture everyone else, but I don't want anyone to come near me. So to be able to use that and then also touch on COVID, I mean, that's easy. You know, I even thought about the COVID piece with, you know, always having to put something in your nose to check to see if you're positive or negative. So I really like that concept. The last question that I really had for you is, you know, costs, money, insurance. I mean, my patients, you know, they always want to know, how much is this going to cost me? Am I going to have to, you know, sell my arm, sell my head, sell my car, my house? Let's talk about this. Because this is a real deal. People want to know how much these items cost. So, you know, like, what does this look like with insurance? And, you know, how do we move forward with our patients if we want them to use this? I know in Raleigh, Durham, where I live, again, I have an amazing rep, Sherry. I want to say Collins. I've known her for quite a bit of time. And she came in and she was able to give me some, you know, tips and things. But I would love to get more information from you two, if you don't mind sharing that piece.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the drug itself is priced similar to other dry eye medications that are currently out there, other branded medications. At the beginning, when we launched products into the marketplace, as you guys know, insurance coverage takes some time. And so we put patient services into place to help patients so that they can experience the drug and help physicians so that they can get experience with the drug. So we, for commercially insured patients at the moment, we have programs where they can pay as little as $0 or $10, depending upon their insurance coverage at the moment. And unfortunately for the Medicare population, there is a way to go through a process of, you know, requesting access to the drug, but that goes through a cycle with the government. So we have to be ready every June to put in our application. Unfortunately, just with the cycle and the way we were approved, we missed it. So we'll go into this June. So it'll take some time for those Medicare patients for us to get coverage. But as we start to bring on insurance plans throughout the year, you know, we'll announce that. But for the time being, we do have these bridge programs in place to allow patients to get access to the product. And, you know, that's primarily for the commercially insured patients.
The other thing that we have is, I'm sure Sherry, your rep, told you that if you write this prescription to PhilRx, which is a mail order kind of pharmacy.
Right.
The thing that I want is I want it to be easy for the eye care provider. And I think that we all hate the word prior authorization.
I was going to say, just, don't say it. Don't say it.
We hate say that it word. Okay. So when our market access team was trying to figure out how are we going to get this on shelves, how are we going to get this in patients' hands, I was so annoying. I'm like, we have to find some way to help with the PA. We cannot make people do PAs as often as you have to do them. So by partnering with this company, PhilRx, they do a lot of the legwork, a lot of the legwork that makes it easier. I'm not saying they do it 100%, But from what I've seen, it should make it easier for you and easier for your patients. And as opposed to some of the other systems that the three of us have used, they're not going to call your patients. Because if someone calls the patients, we all think it's a robocall. And none of us are going to answer it, so the patients aren't going to answer it. So we've developed a way that they text your patients. And it's secure and it's safe, and they can text your patients so that they can exchange the information to do a lot of that background legwork to make it easier for both the patients and the eye care providers. And that's our goal.
Yeah, and Sherry told me about that, and I love that. And I love the brochure, the literature that you have that you can give the patients where it just breaks it down from top to bottom, and you're able to let them know exactly what to do. And also, I think if they take it to certain pharmacies, there's like a QR code or something like that that's on there that helps out as well. So you've really thought about it from top to bottom to make it easier.
Yeah, we wanted to make sure that, you know, there's some patients out there, as you know, that, you know, want to go to the traditional pharmacy that's around the corner, and they've gone to the pharmacy for 40 years and they know their pharmacist, right? And they want to go there. So we've made it easy for them to go there. But also, if they don't want to go to the pharmacy, if they're like me, I want everything just delivered and, you know, brought to the house. I mean, Amazon comes to my house on a pretty regular basis. So, we've tried to offer those services to make it easy for the patients either way.
Yeah, no, I love it. I mean, anything you could do to keep PAs out of my office and allow my team to actually just work with the patients, to me, that's a win-win, and I love that. And just keep up the great work on that. And good luck when June comes around. I know that's a process, better you than me, but I'm looking forward to the end results so that we can continue to help our patients with this. Yeah. But no, you guys, this has been great. This has been fantastic. You know, Terravia is purely innovation. I think it's a great resource for our patients. I think you've done a hell of a job really making it easy to put in the hands of the patients. And I really love all the tips, the pearls that you left with us today. It's really going to help me to go into my clinic tomorrow, have this conversation with my patients, tell them that it's a better alternative than putting something in the eye, and let them know that in order to get it, you know, simple as me sending that message over to the pharmacy and them getting a text and making it happen. That is what I love. That is what I need. That will make life so much easier in patient care. So I just want to say thank you in regards to that.
Yeah, no, yes, thank
definitely.
You.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank all of you guys as well, because we had so many great optometrists and ophthalmologists in our clinical trial. And, you know, we couldn't have done it without the partnership of everybody bringing those, you know, dry eye patients into the clinical development program and seeing them through. And so we really are excited about, you know, the partnership to date, and obviously developing more therapies for patients as we go forward.
Awesome. Well, everyone, it's your favorite optometrist, Dr. Daryl Glover, and the lovely Dr. Anna Lazar. Jeffrey, Marion, we really appreciate you hanging out with us. For everyone out there that really wants to take, you know, dry eye to the next level, make sure you click that link or check out that link, Terravia-pro.com, so you can learn more. It's a lot of great information there for eye care professionals, but also for the patients. So make sure you check it out and make sure you take eye care to the next level. Everyone stay healthy, blessed, and positive. Until next time, peace.
All right, colleagues, and it's a wrap. Thank you dearly for hanging out with the Defocus Media team. We hope truly something resonated with you. And if it did, be sure to give us 5 stars and make sure you follow us on all social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, you named it. And our handle is @DefocusMedia on all platforms. And until next time, be sure to keep it 2020, and we look forward to seeing you on the next episode.